now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Bad news, girls. The good news is your dates are here.
What's the bad news?
They're dead.
Ah!
See, a United States astral robot becomes a creature of death.
Oh. And babes.
We have come here to this planet for one purpose only, to acquire breeding stuff to repopulate our planet.
He who breaks the law shall be punished. Back to the House of Pain! Back to the House of Pain!
Welcome to Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. From classic cults and all the cheese in between, the movies are B, the entertainment is grade A, and I am your host, Mr. Jason Giaconetti, and I am joined by my dad, Mr. Al Giaconetti.
Hi, Jay, how you doing today? Today we're going to do one of the great movies of all time, and it was a seminal moment in my young life, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
And we'll get to it right after this.
Journey to a magical time when demons and heroes battled for the golden treasures and human spoils of forgotten kingdoms.
Kill him.
Thrilled to the story of a legendary superhero who fights through all the torments of hell to save the woman he loves from the world's most powerful sorcerer. This is Sinbad's greatest adventure. The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. She was once a beautiful princess. The sadistic magician shrinks her to the size of a tiny doll. And now, Sinbad must do the impossible to save her. He must destroy a legion of hell-spawned monsters on the death-shrouded island of Colossa. See the flashing death of the living skeleton. See the attack of the giant two-headed bird. See the dance of the cobra woman and feel her deadly slithering embrace. See the spectacular battle between the one-eyed cyclops and the fire-breathing dragon. The incredible magic of Dinorama recreates the enchanted, breathtaking adventure that could never be told before. The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad was released December 23rd, 1958, with an 88-minute running time. It was directed by Nathan Duran. Producers, of course, are that's who everyone knows here. It's going to be Charles Schneer and Ray Harryhausen. Written by Kenneth Kolb, and I know Harryhausen doesn't get writing credit on this one. He often does, but let's face it, he did a lot of the writing himself for that. Obviously, it's based on Sinbad the Sailor. Your stars are Kieran Matthews here as Sinbad. Thorin Thatcher plays Sakura, and Catherine Grant was...
Princess
wife?
Parissa.
Right, but that's whose wife?
That's Bing Crosby's wife.
Bing Crosby's wife, right.
I mean, you talk about a May-December marriage.
Yeah.
At this point, Bing Crosby's probably in his late 70s, and she can't be more than 25.
Right, but she didn't act in many movies. She actually became... No, she did a few.
She did a few.
And then she didn't act much. She was actually... She was married to Bing Crosby and was home with the kids, so...
Yep.
Production companies, Morningside Studio, even though obviously distribution by Columbia. Morningside, of course, we know that's Harryhausen's company, or into his company, the company that he's most associated with. Budget was around $650,000. Now, to find actual, I dug around, I didn't find any actual box office receipts, but The one that's come around has said it's about 3.2 million just in the U.S. and Canada rentals. So that doesn't mean, obviously, rentals of DVDs. It means rentals of the film.
Right.
So $3.2 million in 1958 money is really good money on a $650,000 investment. So, I mean, again, and this was shot, overseas. It wasn't shot in some soundstage. This was shot overseas.
It was
overseas,
shot in Spain. It was shot in Grenada and Spain.
Right, exactly. But it wasn't shot on some soundstage in Hollywood like other movies at this time, or in the deserts behind the Universal lot, which, a lot of Westerns were filmed in and stuff. Obviously, as we've mentioned, this is a Harryhausen picture. This is, one of our fancy the scrapbooks here. That old film fantasy scrapbook that we spent years going through and studying every picture. And I think we see this movie hundreds and hundreds of times. So let's get right into this. Here we go. So obviously, the story opens as Sinbad and his crew land their ship on the Isle of Colossa, where they encounter Sakura, the magician, fleeing from the giant Cyclops. Now, let's just stop there for a second. The Cyclops, of course, is one of the most iconic things Harryhausen has ever made. He purposely made sure that the legs were like styro legs. They were bent in, so you couldn't have a man in a costume wearing it. He stole some of the... Well, I'm not saying stole. He took some of the ideas about with the fur legs from Pan. This is not the Cyclops you see in the Iliad and the Odyssey and things like that. This is not a talking beast. This is a true animal grunting and, screaming. They escape with their lives, but Sakura manages to lose the magic lamp. So this movie opens. I think this is, again, if you haven't seen this movie, you definitely should watch this. This is amazing. This movie opens real hot. They talk about a hot opening and things. And we'll talk more about that as we get to other Harryhausen movies and other movies of this time. This was a hot open. As you get there, they're on the sea. Like, all right, they're on land. They're getting this. The cave face, where they come upon the cave, which is that very iconic face there. You're kind of like, what are we looking at? And all of a sudden, Sakura comes out and he's being chased by the Cyclops. And you're just blown away by the Cyclops because nothing looked like that.
It's like 5 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
So they hook you right away. Right. Actually, the what hooked me immediately, and again, I had no idea what I was going to see as an 8-year-old boy, 9-year-old boy, was the music. The opening, Bernard Herrmann is the composer was a composer of many, many movies, and including the A-list pictures that he did with Alfred Hitchcock.
Of course.
But the opening theme, that bump, 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 it just, all of a sudden they say, wow, this is, I'm looking forward to the rest of this movie. And then sure enough, 5 minutes in, the Cyclops shows up and your jaw is on your chest because, holy God, what the heck is going on here?
Well, Harryhausen originally didn't want him. He wanted
Miklos Rosa.
That's who he wanted.
Yep, and Miklos Rosa at that time was definitely an A-list composer.
Right.
He had done many, many major films. He was to go on in a couple of more years to do the score to El Cid, which is considered, even from the classical side and not so much from a movie side, but as a classical composer, as one of the greatest scores ever done.
Well, it was actually Schneer who convinced Harryhausen to use Bernard Herrmann. And then, of course, it was well received, and they wound up being the composer for Three Worlds of Gulliver, Mysterious Island, Jason and the Argonauts, so that's 1960, 61, 63. And then eventually, Harryhausen got to work with Rosa on Golden Voyage back in 73, 74. But the whole point, the music does hook you, and you're in, and then it opens on that foggy ship, and you're like, okay, as soon as they land on the island, it doesn't stop. And once you see the Cyclops, even though the Cyclops battle is quick, and he throws the rock, and they escape, now they're going to go back to Baghdad, because Princess Chandra is on the boat with them, and it's to keep peace. She's the princess of Chandra.
Yeah,
It's Parissa. They're trying to keep peace between Chandra and Baghdad.
Yeah. Now, as they're going back, the magician Torrin Thatcher, who's Sakura, is trying to convince Sinbad to take him back so he can get the lamp. Now, Torrin Thatcher, for those of you who may not know, he was never an A-list actor, but he always acted as a bad guy. He was actually the magician in Jack the Giant Killer a couple of years later.
He plays the same character.
Basically the same, but
bigger eyebrows.
But bigger eyebrows.
He has giant eyebrows in Jack the Giant Killer.
But he based his character on the 1940s Thief of Baghdad, Conrad mm-hmm. Veidt, mm-hmm. who was, and a matter of fact, if you see the Thief of Baghdad, what was always funny to me, is that when I saw the Disney movie Aladdin, the Jafar looks just like Conrad Veidt from 1940.
Yeah.
But that's who Thorin Thatcher based his evilness, so to speak,
right.
on.
So but the whole point is, Parissa's on the boat, so Sinbad's certainly not going to risk, going back to the island for this that he doesn't even understand necessarily what the lamp is, and it's not important to him, but it's clearly very important to Segura. So anyway, they return back to Baghdad, where Sinbad is treated like he's not really the prince, but he's treated as if he's the prince. Right. The Sultan has made him his son, and they're going to have a wedding. So what happens is, obviously, Parissa's father, the Sultan of Chandra, right, he arrives as a guest of honor, and Sakura is asked to do some magic at the festivities, which is where he turns Parissa's handmaiden into the Serpent Woman, right? But that's a very famous scene, because, there's some talking here. It's just like there's just talking and talking. There's not a lot of talking, but you have some talking, and this is where I would feel... if you hadn't seen the Cyclops, the real hot open, you might be like, oh God, can we get to this already? But as soon as he throws, it's the best when the maiden gets into the thing, and Catherine Grant goes, it's a serpent! She'll be killed! And may Allah have mercy on them both, right? Kind of thing. And it's just so offhanded, like the little with the
banter. It was just
the Sultan of Chandra has some of the best lines in the movie, because you're just like, he's just so flippant, kind of thing. And of course, what emerges, he cracks it open, and then we have the very famous. She has four arms and the snake body, and she's dancing.
As a matter of fact, her lower body, which is the snake part. Would resurface in a way many years later in Clash of the Titans as the Medusa character. Obviously not the same, but when you've seen the two movies, that's what brings it to
that's
mind.
That's what Haley said. We watched it again this morning. When Haley got up early while Kelly was still sleeping, and we watched it. Haley was like, "We're gonna put a movie on." She's like, "Oh, I want to watch whatever Disney Channel." I put it on. The music starts. She goes, "Oh, right, we're Seven Voyages in bed," and she's eating her yogurt, excited, and she goes, is that Medusa? And I said, well, no, it's a snake. He goes, but that looks like Medusa, Dad. And, which is kind of funny. So, after that happens, Sakura asks for a boat and men to go back to his island, and the Sultan says no. So then the Sultan of Chandra asks him to read the future, and he clearly is just lying. Now, the thing is, they get taken advantage of. Sakura is working them like a fiddle. He is just playing these guys. He's like, oh, I can't do anything. I can't help you.
Tell me what you see.
Yeah.
I see war.
Yeah. he can't help him, but but maybe if you give me a ship, maybe this bad stuff won't happen. And it's like, they're like, you got to look and be like, this is the guy. If they had just killed him there, it's a very boring story.
Right.
But
well, they obviously know he's being a charlatan at this point, so they banish him. And if he's caught within the walls of Baghdad by sundown, he'll lose his eyes.
He'll put out his eyes, right? But what I'm saying is, but at that point, if they've been like, just run him through, like just kill him, right? Then the rest of the movie doesn't happen, because they never go back to the island. Nothing ever happens. But it's like, okay, like, it's hard because you look at it now, you're like, how are they falling for this? But they have to fall for it for the movie to happen. Anyway, so he says something, there's going to be a war between Chandra and Baghdad, and everyone will die, and the streets will run red with blood, the whole nine. Well, what happens is he then sneaks in to Parissa's bedroom and shrinks her in one of... It's very effective still, even on the Blu-ray. And again, you can see the traveling mat and stuff on the Blu-ray. But that was shot... Catherine Grant's arm was actually strapped down to the pillow... And the camera was actually pulled back. It's a simple, tiny technique, but they pulled the camera back, and it made her arm look like she's shrinking. And now she's the tiny hand, you know, she fits inside your hand, which is, again, on the poster. Very famous part of this movie.
And then with the rest of the scene, they actually built, I think Harryhausen said it was 30 feet by 20 feet high, the pillow that she's actually sitting on. So it's at that point, it's not forced perspective anymore, but now it's an actual right. huge prop.
They filmed her on the pillow, and then they filmed Kieran Matthews, and then the two overlays go together.
Right.
And obviously, during this time, now they have to go back to the island, because Sakura said the only way to fix her is to get back to the island, and I need a piece of the eggshell from the rock, which is the two-headed bird that lives on the island. So they build the giant crossbow, which, to me, is not the most effective weapon in the world, but it's awesome, because it's just such a big weapon. So Sinbad's got to get the ship, and he has a couple of men, including Harufa, who are loyal to him, and they will sail with him. But they just, you know, this is where they have to go to the prison to get a bunch of guys. So
right, and they get some of the scummiest guys. But think about this: these are just the I don't want to say rapists, but they were
thieves and murderers,
and they look like they haven't done a day's worth of work in forever. But he gets 25 of these guys. Now they all become sailors and are. What was their profession before they became sailors? But yet they're on the ship. But the dialogue that is added says that you can't trust any of these guys. It's going to be a rough voyage, which is fine. So that was really.
Well, Sakura even hears on the boat they're plotting against them,
right?
And they're going to try. And he warns them, and he says, "We'll make landfall." And it's all about the men being, you know, they don't want to be at sea because they're looking at it. They could be pirates. So like, we could take the ship and we could, you know, hit the trading routes. We could become rich men by stealing from, you know.
Right. But again, were they sailors before? They don't really bring that out. All I know is that you get these guys are in rags and they're on the ship. None of them's got shoes on. It's a good scene because of the characters that they costumed.
Yeah, the smell would be something else. All right, so obviously they try to overthrow the ship, and that's when, because they have no weapons, they're just numbers, and they start beating up all the guys, and they have one sword which they take off of one of Sinbad's men, and that's when they the sword fight. Then there's sword fights, and that's the thing about this movie. This is not just monster movie. There's sword fighting and stuff on the ship. There's piratey stuff happening, right, which is important because... sometimes the movies would get bogged down in trying to be creature, and if they weren't well done, you're like, ugh, you know, or it's all like piratey movie stuff, you know. But so,
yeah, but this flows very well.
That's what I'm saying. So, that's when they go towards ship. So they almost get crashed in the rocks because of the island full of the screaming sirens.
Well, that's that is a playback or a reference back to the earlier movie called Ulysses with Kirk Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
The sirens are a part of Greek mythology, and Sakura says if we can steer the ship towards the, because we have to go by that island, the sirens will make everybody crazy. So Sinbad says, okay, we'll put wax on the ends of pieces of cotton and put them in our ears so that we don't hear it. And that's how the story, the plot then turns around, because the sailors don't know this. And the crew goes crazy, and they rush in to Sinbad, where he's being held captive, and say, save us, save us. And that's how the next part of the story unfolds.
I think a lot of this movie, if you look at a lot of different things, there's pieces from Greek mythology, there's pieces from Arabian Nights, there's pieces... Right. The one thing, again, I know Harryhausen didn't get a writing credit here, but this is all Harryhausen stuff. He wanted to make these kind of things. He loved the Arabian Nights and all those stories. When you watch the documentary... the new one, the one that just came out last year, Harryhausen, the Titan one. He talks about how, you know, he wanting to make these movies, and these are the kind of things, these are stories he has from his childhood.
Well, what he had said with him and Charles Schneer, they had done all these contemporary movies in today's world, you know, which was the 20,000 Leagues, I mean, 20... the
Dreaming of Beast, Earth, Beast of Adams,
So they wanted to get away from that and do something where he could be much more creative.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to see Cyclops and two-headed rocks.
There's only so many times a monster can destroy a city. You know, there's only so many cities you can destroy. So they land on Colossus. Sinbad, Sakura, and six crew members enter what's called the Valley of the Cyclopses, because that's far scarier than the Valley of the Dolls. So they split up.
You would think.
Well, no, Valley of Dolls is pretty scary. But they split up. So three go with Sinbad, and three go with Sakura. So there's three together.
This is the only. And I'm a continuity buff, and this is the only continuity error in the movie. When they break up, there's three go with Sinbad, as Jason said, and three go with Sakura. When they get to a watering hole, Sakura's men, there's now four of them. Now the what happens in the movie after everybody breaks up is Harufa by himself comes down the pathway and eventually joins up with Sinbad, and Sinbad says to him, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I've left enough men to guard the ship. I want to help you." There's no indication anywhere that a fourth sailor by himself has come down and found Sakura. I mean, these guys are not the brightest bulb in the box.
Anyway, so that they split up, and then Sinbad you know, his group, they find the giant club with the spikes in it. And then that's when he finds Harufa, and the two other men find the cave. And that's when Harufa finds them in there, and then Sinbad goes through, so there'll be time for riches later. We have to get the egg. And that's when they're fighting amongst the riches. So Sinbad's fighting off the guys, and Harufa's trying to help him. And then that's when the Cyclops rips the top of the rock off the top of the cave, the main cave, and then captures all of them and puts them in the cage.
The cage.
He puts them in the wooden cage, which I think is really funny because it has a top trap door and a little thing. Like, obviously that's what it would be, but it's like, you know, like,
well, it's huge, and again, there's no way one guy underneath can push the latch.
Yeah. So he captures them, and that's when he brings over and he carries it over to what is clearly a spit, right, with a little stool,
and he grabs Harufa
and he ties Harufa on, and the best is he licks his lips as he starts roasting him on the fire. To me, it's always funny because there's a model kit that's called the playset, right, and it's called the Cyclops playset. And when I said that to Haley, I said, "Well, remember, Grandpa has the Cyclops playset." She goes, "He has a playset to play with Cyclops." I'm like, "No, it's a model."
It's a model.
And she's like, "Oh, that'd be a really cool toy." And I was like, "Well, yeah, but they don't have that."
But you see that scene, that little bit of him, of the Cyclops licking his lips, is quintessential Harryhausen.
Oh, sure.
That little motion that the Cyclops does brings more, I don't want to say humanity, but it brings more.
But it makes it look alive. It's not just a guy in a suit who can't emote. It's stop motion, and Harryhausen gets a lot of emoting out of his guy. You know?
Well, the other thing is that before the Cyclops actually gets them in the treasure room, there's a whole bunch of skulls and all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's already had a meal.
Well, that's the whole thing.
In a while.
Every time they crash, he goes and he takes their treasure and he eats all the people. And well, him and the other Cyclops do.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Sakura has the men camp out by the river, and he goes up. He hears what's happening, and he goes and doesn't help them escape. He goes to look for the lamp because Sakura's entire motive is to get the lamp. And that's when Sinbad reveals the princess to the men in the cage with him, and he shows them, you know, and she goes on top, and she's able to pop it open. Once the Cyclops hears Sakura rumbling, you know, trashing through the room looking for the lamp, they're able to go. She frees them. They get out, and they untie Sakura. Now, the problem is they don't untie Harufa immediately because the Cyclops comes back. So Harufa's just hanging there, and he's hanging there. And Haley goes, "Aren't they going to untie him?" I go, "Well, Haley, the Cyclops is there, honey." She goes, "Okay, but he's just hanging on there, Dad, you know." And that, of course, the men, Sakura's men, are told not to drink the water. It's poison. So Golar is not, you know, afraid.
Right.
So he drinks it, and it turns out to be wine. So they get trashed. And they come now. They drunkenly come up and start attacking the Cyclops. Well, that leads to one of them throwing the spear in his back, which actually saves Sinbad and allows that scene to unfold. And he takes the tree, King Kong-ish.
He rips the tree.
Rips the tree out. But it's very much like a throwback to a King Kong kind of thing, where he now has the tree and stomps them with the... He kills three of them. Right? He's killing them with the tree, which, again, it shows Harryhausen's love for Willis O'Brien and all the stuff that came before. But then that leads to them and the Cyclops looking in, trying to grab Sinbad. And Sinbad, of course, blinds the Cyclops, which is directly from... what's his face? Blind him. Is that the Odyssey?
Yeah,
right?
Ulysses.
Ulysses.
Yeah.
And he blinds the Cyclops.
Yep.
But the difference here is there's no... You know, he doesn't yell out... Polyphemus doesn't yell out, "No man is hurting me," because he tells him his name is No Man. But it's a clear reference to that. So he blinds the Cyclops... And then he leads him here, and he leads him and goes off the cliff.
Goes off the cliff.
To his death. And you're thinking, like, awesome, like, great, the Cyclops is dead. And Sakura goes, "There are more of these. This is not the only one." You know, and it's like, it's such a like, "Wow, we did this. Oh, there's more," you know, kind of thing. And like, so then they go, they climb the rocks, and that's when one of the men falls off. And he says, "Allah has many ways dealing with hungry men." It's very much like that they're hungry. They're all, like, they're starving and they're exhausted. They find the egg, which hasn't hatched yet, of the rock.
Yeah, the baby egg.
And they crack the egg open, and they kill the baby rock and eat it.
And eat it.
Yeah, right, and now he has the eggshell, right? My only problem with that scene is, again, I know there's, like, they kill the baby rock, right? And they're like, "Well, let's start eating." Like, it's kind of hard to tell how long that, you know, happens there, because it's supposed to be getting, like, is it, like, are they there for a while? Is it quick? Because that leg, they cut the leg off.
And they're actually cooking it.
Yeah, so, but I'm saying that leg's been cooking for a while.
Well,
so
Sakura keeps looking up at the sky, so it's obvious that the mother is not there right away.
Right, right. What I'm saying is, but just kind of, you kind of don't have a reference to how long they've been there. Because you're thinking, like, if you just killed a baby that would, you know, you're eating, they're eating it, you would think they might not try to cook the entire giant leg. Maybe get some smaller meat, cook it, and get out of there, get out of town. But that's when the Rock shows up, and that's when we, before the Rock shows up, actually, we have the scene where the princess goes into the lamp and meets Barani.
Right.
She slides down and meets him, and then you're taken inside the lamp, which, of course, was so mystical. It's a room full of dry ice and, you know, it's like a smoke machine and whatever.
It's very effective
because what does the inside of the lamp look like? It's not going to be like couches and stuff.
Yeah. And,
you know,
and then the reason that she's down in there is that Sinbad realizes that
Twice Sakura has almost killed them trying to get this lamp back.
But the lamp has saved them. So he has, Parissa says, well, I'm small enough. Let me slide down. And he says, well, it may be very dangerous. And she said, let me try. So when she slides down, the genie, who's probably a 10 or 12-year-old boy, his name is Richard Eyre.
Yeah.
He plays the genie. Does a very effective job for the smaller part that he has. But again, obviously, as a genie, he's the most important guy to help them. When she slides into the lamp, which is it's really a beautiful scene in there. There's dry ice and a lot of different colors, but it's very effective because it looks like what it would be like inside of a lamp, not just the bottomless pit of let's say a coffee can. So she talks to the genie and she says, how can you help us? And she says, I need to know the words that would summon you from the lamp. And the genie is very hesitant at that point because he said, it's a very powerful wish that I have to grant you. And she says, well, how can we help you? And she says, well, there is an old proverb that says I can be freed from the lamp if these steps are all done. And so Princess Parissa says, well, we will help you. We do not want to hurt you in any way. We want to help you. So he then grants her the words to say to summon him from the lamp. And that those words are, from the land beyond, from the world past hope and fear, I bid you, genie, now appear. And then Parissa says, well, what is the spell that we need to say to free you? And the words to free him, and
what has to occur?
Well, it's the riddle.
It's the riddle.
The riddle is, when the big that is small shall again become tall, into fiery rock to rise you must fall. Again, it's a riddle, and at this point, they're just words. But she then climbs back out and tells Sinbad how to summon the genie, and then the rest of the movie continues.
Well, that's when the Rock attacks. The Rock, as in the ROC Rock, not the Rock as Dwayne Johnson.
Dwayne Johnson.
I said to Haley, that's the Rock. She goes, the Rock's in this? And I said, you know better than that. Obviously, the Rock attacks. That's when the two other men are killed. The lamp is knocked out of Sinbad's hand as he's trying to call for the genie. Harufa grabs the lamp and throws it back to Sinbad, which ultimately spells his demise as Sakura kills him.
Right.
The Rock carries Sinbad, the lamp, off. The princess tries to escape, but Sakura grabs her and then takes her back to his underground castle. And that's when Sinbad's able to escape the nest, and he calls upon Barani and says, well, where is she? And he tells her, in the underground castle, I'll meet you there. Right. Meet me there? Like, how will I know?
Now, when the Rock picks up Sinbad, and Sinbad has the lamp and puts him in the nest, that's a very similar scene to a movie that's going to come in about 10 years, the 1 million years BC with Raquel Welch, where she's put into the nest. But again, it's still a very effective scene, and he's dropped into the nest. Now, there's no young chicks in there.
To eat them.
To eat them. But there's a lot of bones. A lot of bones.
So, obviously...
Well, one of the other things that I wanted to mention, at this point, the princess, after they come off the ship, Sinbad, they built her
a little jeweler's box,
which is very plush inside, but it's not meant to be hung on your waist and walk around. But the scenes that Sinbad is being manhandled by the Cyclops. He's being picked up by his feet, flung around, put into the thing. She's in this little box. But every time she comes out of the box, her hair is coiffed nice.
Yeah, well.
But again, it's not like she's strapped in. She's being bounced around side to side. So it's almost like an insane asylum box where you the walls are padded.
All right. Well, so Sinbad goes to the castle, to the underground lair, which is at the mouth of the Valley of the Cyclops. And that's where we first see the dragon, which is a very, very famous dragon. Harryhausen's dragon. The tongue, the forked tongue sticking out of the mouth. It has that fire. It breathes fire like a flamethrower. That's where Sinbad rolls it in to choke it against the side of the wall, gets past, and releases it. Sinbad's then able to get into. Then he's coming through the cavern, and that's when we see Sakura shows her on the crystal ball that he's coming. And then you have now it's time to make her big again, and kind of thing. And they go in there, and Sinbad's like, "I'll kill you. You better do this if you do anything to her." And he has the best line, "Give me the eggshell." And Haley loves that line. She would say that to you all the time. "Grandpa, Grandpa, give me the eggshell." Right, kind of thing, you know. She loves saying that. And it's a great line. And he brings her back with all the green smoke going everywhere, which actually comes off and going up around his head. You can see it, like, plooping up his head. I mean, there's a lot of smoke.
But it's a really good scene.
Yeah.
I mean, it really portrays him as a magician.
Yeah.
And the look on his face, it's this very sinister but gleeful scene.
Well, because he thinks he's getting the lamp back.
Yeah.
And then he goes, "Well, I'll give you the lamp. We get back to the ship." And he's like, "All right." You know, it's like, the thing is, at no point has he been trustworthy the entire time. Well, and again, he is still not trustworthy.
Right. And now he's pissed.
Yeah. Well, but then he goes, that's when he brings the skeleton to life off the wall, which, of course, is a very, very famous scene. That was all done, again, if you ever watch any of the documentaries, they show it. Kieran Matthews was no sword fighting, master, but he trained with someone who would teach him how to duel. And then the person he was dueling with, they would run through the scene. And then Kieran Matthews would do the scene cold. He had to just remember his steps. And then the skeleton was added in, obviously, with the dynamation.
And the sword fighter who was the main guy. That's in the movie. That's what the skeleton's doing,
right? Yeah,
because Harryhausen then
mashed it. But he's not in the. It's not Harryhausen that cut him out. Like, they did the scene and did the scene and did the scene,
right?
And then Kieran Matthews had hit all his marks. It just was his marks, but it's very effective. It looks like he's actually fighting a skeleton.
And the music at this point,
it's a
staccato type of. Up, and it just builds and builds and builds, and it's just what more can you say about it?
Yeah.
The one thing I must say about this is that to see this movie on a VHS or even the early DVDs was one thing. On Blu-ray, all the scenes with the live actors are absolutely pristine, but the flaw with the Blu-ray is that one thing about especially this fight, it's very noticeable, the live action versus the stop motion. The live action seems a little blurry in the background. Because it has to, because of the traveling mats and the rear projection. But it doesn't detract from the scene. It's just that when you're watching the movie with a critical eye, you can see how this is being done. Obviously, it's not all being done in camera, so to speak.
Right, yeah.
But, I mean, it's just an incredible scene.
Yeah.
And that was considered to be one of the most... iconic pieces that Harryhausen had ever done. And from this movie on, all of his other creatures, he just ramps it up.
Well, he had to, because he got to the point where people weren't going to accept you doing less, so everything became more. That's why there are 7 Sons of the Hydra. That's why there are the Children of the Hydra in Jason Yorganis. That's why those things exist, because he had to do more.
Right,
and more.
7 heads in the
Hydra had to be more. Everything had to be more and more and more. Talos had to be more, because you couldn't just have the Cyclops again. You couldn't just have this one skeleton again. He fights him up the stairway to nowhere, kind of thing, which obviously led to something at one point. But that's all in ruins. The whole place is in ruins outside of his where his chamber is.
Right.
Yeah. So, and he knocks him off. Because Haley had said, "Why doesn't he just stab him?" I was like, "Well, stab what? There's nothing there.
The sword goes through."
And she goes, "Oh, well, that's a good point. Just why don't you chop his head off?" I said, "Okay." They do that. And she's thinking of Jason Yorganis. Because they do stab him, Jason Yorganis, and it doesn't do anything. And they wind up knocking its head off and doing whatever. So,
and this scene, the scene at the end when Sinbad knocks the skeleton off, when the skeleton falls to the ground, that's a real skeleton
shattering
yeah. on the ground.
Well, that makes sense, though.
Yes.
So again, they go to escape. Sakura smashes the crystal ball with the mace, which knocks the bridge out. Which then they summon Barani again, and he helps them, and the princess summons him this time, and he's very happy to help her,
yeah.
because he knows that she would not summon him unless they needed it. That's the scene right from Star Wars, because George Lucas lifted it from this movie, where they swing to safety.
Yeah.
Right? It's not even close. No. It's exactly the Star Wars. There's even the little bridgey things.
Yeah, and you know what's really amazing about this? Even though he's a genie, he's not killing people.
No, he doesn't. Yeah.
All he does is give you the means to get away.
Right. So they escape, and that's when Carissa tells him that I made him a promise, and they throw the lamp into the lava underneath,
right.
which, Sakura is just, no! It's like someone hitting the face with a fridge, blah, 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 you know, kind of thing. He's just like, no, don't throw it down there, like that. They escape. They get past the dragon, and they go out the front of the cave.
Yeah,
what happens?
The
Cyclops, the two-horned Cyclops is there. She screams, and now... Again, I don't know what she... Again, she's not screaming at an actual Cyclops, but she sells that. Catherine Grant sells that. She's like, holy... And she screams. They go back into the cave, and that's when he chops the wheel. To release the dragon.
Right, and the Cyclops follows them back into the cave.
Of course,
cave.
The Cyclops coming after them.
Yeah.
So the Cyclops and that... And that's that's probably the most famous scene in the entire movie, is the Cyclops and the dragon fighting. There's a lot of very famous scenes. The Cyclops and the dragon fighting... People have stolen that idea and put that in movies for years and years and years and years. And it's not anything crazy. But as Luke always said, a bipedal monster fighting a four-legged monster, and here it is. And the dragon's much more powerful than the Cyclops. The Cyclops doesn't have any weapons or anything like that. And he winds up killing him, right? Originally, the end of that wasn't supposed to be... It was supposed to be two Cyclopses fighting. That was the original ending they were supposed to have. And then they scrapped it and went with the dragon because it made more sense. So now that's when Sakura comes out and he goes, follow, right? And here comes the dragon. And he's followed. Now, they run out the mouth of the giant face of the cave, right? And he goes, man the crossbow. And they're like, why? They're like, just do it. They're pulling. And there's 20 guys pulling back this arrow. And the only thing he didn't say was, pull till your hearts break, which is Jason the Argonauts. And then when the dragon appears, right, and they shoot the arrow, and it's, again, it's not the most effective weapon in the world, but it's 100 effective right here, because it impales right into there. And you hear the cry it makes, and then it falls and crushes Sakura, right? Which is, exactly how that guy should have died, because he's kind of been a jerk the whole time. Now his monster kills him. That he's bringing to kill them,
right?
Because all he wants is the lamp. He wants nothing but... He's greedy, and he wants the lamp. Which is, and then they escape, because then the dragon comes and dies in the beach, and they escape, right?
Yeah. Now the thing, when the Cyclops is killed by the dragon, his death roar is it's the same as the Ymir from 20 million miles to Earth, and the dragon's death scene where he has the death rattle is very, very similar to the Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. But again, it's still a very effective scene.
It's a four-legged monster dying. I mean,
well, the thing is that Harryhausen's dragon, he made it specifically without wings. I mean, when you think of a dragon, you always think of a flying dragon. This was more of a, I don't want to say an alligator.
Well,
no,
it was more of like a dinosaur.
Like a dinosaur.
Yeah. Because that makes more sense. A flying dragon, you chained up in a cage. Like, it just seems like this wouldn't be that type of dragon. So they're back on the boat. And of course, they're, Carissa says, I will always remember,
Barani.
They get that she'll always miss, obviously, what the heck's his name? Harufa, who sacrificed his life to save them. And then she'll miss Barani. And he said, who, Barani? She goes, the little, genie. He only wanted to be a sailor. And then he shows up because he still had a little bit of magic left, right? Which is a great scene, because again, the movie ends on a very up note. He's basically like their kid, kind of thing at this point, because they saved him and he wants to be a sailor like Sinbad. And he puts all the gold and treasure in the room.
Well, that's
he's got enough magic left there.
The treasure room you would need an army full of men to get it all
out
of
this.
Well, yeah, but again, but when he once the lamp is thrown into the lava, how does he still have?
He probably still has some magic left. You're willing to believe everything at this point. I don't know how he got it there, piece by piece. I don't know. Like he got it there. We have to believe that he got it there.
Yes.
So, and of course, it ends obviously as they're sailing off. Originally, there was talk of Barani being in a postscript, you know, then him not being there, and him actually being a captain like Sinbad and married to his own princess. Like, it was supposed to be, he was going to be the next Sinbad. Yeah. But they were like, no, let's scale that back.
Well, I remember when I left this movie, I was saying, I said to myself, boy, I can't wait for the eighth voyage.
Yeah.
Other names.
Right. But the seventh voyage of Sinbad, what about the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, you know, sixth? You know, they never existed.
Well, one of the things that Harryhausen had talked about was that there was the, is it the 12 labors of Hercules?
Yeah.
That was one of the things he wanted to do, was to show, you know, have a movie of the 12 labors, because there were all kinds of things he has to fight and creatures have you. But that never came about.
Yeah. So obviously, we talked about the dragon breathing fire. It was actually done with a flamethrower on set, you know, kind of thing. So the scenes where it does breathe fire, Harry used a flamethrower shooting out 30 to 40 feet against the night sky, and then superimpose that in, of course, there. And it's very effective. When it opens its mouth, I mean, it's not Godzilla. It's not shooting a beam. It's shooting fire, and it's pulling the fire up from inside itself. I think of, it's not a very good movie, but I think of Rain of Fire, that movie with Matthew McConaughey and... Christian Bale, where the dragons, where they had, well, the fire's made here, and they cut open the dragon, they show you that it's a sack on the inside and it's putting it together. That's what it looks like. It's not just it's breathing fire all the time, it's actually pushing something from its stomach up its throat and breathing fire, which makes it much more effective, as because he doesn't breathe fire all that much, and he doesn't use the fire against any creature we ever see. And it's not like there's charred, you know, remains of creatures there. But you figure it's just something it can do. But it's not like a Godzilla movie where you would have, let's say, Godzilla breathing his atomic breath. Or, you know, and like Mechagodzilla firing missiles and shooting laser eyes and the whole nine. It's not that. It's totally done there because it's a fire-breathing dragon. It's like to be mythical.
Yeah, now this movie, just one as an aside here, this movie was the first movie that... quote unquote, it was produced in something called Dynamation.
Yep.
Which now Dynamation is just a made up name that Harryhausen did and Schneer did, because at this time in movie making, TV was and even though it was in its infancy, it was starting to really really catch on, and people weren't going to the movies as often. So then you had movies like production things called CinemaScope and 3D. So in order to differentiate the Harryhausen movies, they coined the name Dynamation, and it comes up on the screen in really big letters.
Yeah.
And what that really entailed was nothing more than just rear miniature, rear projection.
It's the same stuff he was doing.
It was the same stuff he was doing, but now calling it Dynamation, all of a sudden now, whoa, what's this?
Yeah, well, it had a name to what it was. Right. He could market the name.
Yes. And that's it stayed Dynamation for
that's what it was known as. Yeah. So the thing is that, I mean, he had Harryhausen's name brought people into theater, but now it says in Dynamation, and it was like, oh my God, oh, I know what Dynamation is, and people think of all the things that happened.
Now, the thing with one of the problems that did arise in this time frame was that the color stock that the DP was using was just one. It was one color stock. There wasn't like it is today.
Yeah. Well.
And so the problem that arises with the projecting the image, in a lot of different scenes, depending on the lighting, the color of the creature
would change.
And so, if you as modelers, what we try to do is we always try to do movie accurate, and sometimes you've got there's three different scenes in three different colors. It's the same creature.
Yeah.
And as the film stock, got better and better and better, that eliminated
some of the color variation. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But
but that's a Harryhausen. That was one of his bugaboos. He said it used to frustrate me like crazy.
Well, yeah.
Because if he's green in this one and he's blue in this one, how do I combat
that? His model didn't change color.
Right.
You know, it was what it was. So. And you'll hear more about that, obviously, as we talk about future Harryhausen movies. Like Golden Voyage of Sinbad, which was made, you know, what, 18 years later or whatever it was. You know, it's in the 70s, 74, 73. You know, he things had gotten better, but they weren't great yet. And, you know, so you have color stuff there. But again, it's all that's why Harryhausen's black and whites had less of an issue with that, because everything was in black and white. And it is ultimately the problem with early color movies when color became more readily available. And again, you're like, but Jay, you know, Wizard of Oz was in color. Wizard of Oz was an A picture, folks. That was a lot of money spent, a lot of things there. And that was the best they could do for a time. And even that has issues. So Dad mentioned, what do you call it, that Edward Small was a director, and he produced a movie in 1962 called Jack the Giant Killer, which has also been released as a musical, and as you name it, it's everything else.
And there's like 15 different cuts of the
movie. Yeah, it's okay. None of them are good. What happened was he really liked this movie. He really liked Seven Voyages of Sinbad, and he said, hey. So he hired almost all the same principal actors, including Kieran Matthews as Jack and Thorin Thatcher as evil wizard Pendragon. Right? And and then he did his own Cyclops. He did the little growing man. Yeah. And Cyclops has two eyes, but it has a horn. And it was Danforth doing all the effects.
Yeah, Jim Danforth did it, and it
took years for him to do, because he was still young. He was still developing what it was. I mean, Danforth went on to do When Dinosaurs Ruled the Earth, which actually took him, the principal photography was done in like 69, and he didn't finish the effects till 72.
And he also did the Seven Faces of Dr. Lau.
Yeah, but I'm saying he became something, Harryhausen had created this, ability to do this, and he worked by himself, or maybe maybe one person came and took the pictures, but a lot of time Harryhausen did it himself. He set the model, took the picture, set the model, took the picture, and he would work, and some days he would work 12, 13 hours and get 15 seconds of film, you know, if they were lucky and it was a good day, and if the weather wasn't too warm, and if the weather wasn't too cold, or it wasn't too humid, or if they had, you know, God forbid, power went out, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Jim Danforth, was a good stop motion animator. It was the creatures that he created, especially in Jack the Giant Killer, that are so cartoonish.
Well, but I think the problem is too, is it's Jack the Giant Killer were supposed to be Seven Voyages of Sinbad redo. And so I think that kind of limited some of the things he could do. Even like some of his more effective scenes in there are the stuff that's not in Seven Voyages of Sinbad, right? You know, kind of thing. And it's just hard. It's hard to remake someone else's movie. And some guys don't want to do it. But again, work is work.
And yet, if you go back and just read reviews, like read Leonard Maltin's review of Jack the Giant Killer, he praises it to no end. And yet, it can't hold a candle to anything.
That's
true. And then to top it off, 1 year later, Jason and the Argonauts comes out, and
blows it all away.
I mean, at this point, as we talked, there are so many different versions of Jack the Giant Killer, because it was received well when it came out, but they decided to turn it into a musical. They took the theatrical version and cut it down to like 65 minutes.
Yeah, they tried a really fast running time. And they tried. Riff Tracks did a live version of it, but it's the fully restored Jack the Giant Killer, and I'm like, wow. Okay, this is probably the best. It's funny. That's the best version of Jack the Giant Killer I've ever seen. Not because they're making fun of it, but just the best version we've ever seen of the movie itself. It's a shame. It's a real shame that Small didn't say, hey, I'm inspired by this. Let me make a different movie. Let me make a different tale. I mean, it's almost the princess is stolen. They go to the island. There's a bird. There's a thing. It's like everything. If he just made a different movie, he might have been able to piggyback onto the success of Harryhausen, and instead of trying to ape off him and not make as much money, carry on. I think of it like this, Jaws is a movie that made a lot of money, and there are a lot of Jaws imitators out there, and some are good, Piranha, and some are really bad, Last Shark. And what happens is, some of those movies made a lot of money because they were really good, and some of those movies made a bunch of money because they played at drive-ins and then got shut down by Universal with a cease and desist order. And this would have been a case where, back in the day, you made this movie, don't call him Sinbad, call him Jack, call Jack the Giant Killer, but have it be a different story. Because Kieran Matthews, let's talk about that for a second, because, call spade a spade. Kieran Matthews, he's Sinbad in this, yes, but he ain't Sinbad. No. Sinbad should be a guy with a turban and a beard. Philip Michael Law. John Philip Law. John Philip Law, not Philip Michael Law, whatever, I added more names. He is probably the best Sinbad of the three.
And he's the head of Golden Voyage.
Yeah. And he is probably the best. He looks like what Sinbad should look like. I mean, again, it's just what it is. Not that Kieran Matthews is, I mean, he's a good looking guy. He went on to play, Three Worlds of Gulliver.
Right.
He was in, Jack the Giant Killer. He made a bunch of movies.
And he made a bunch of other movies too. Not just fantasy films.
But he's certainly not you know, an Arabian prince.
Right. Well, you know, Harryhausen,
he's not Arabian at all.
Harryhausen always praised him because he said he was one of the few professional actors that he worked with that could actually emote emotion. Looking at a head on a stick.
Yeah.
He said a lot of the actors would be turning their heads the wrong way, and he would have to stop the film and say, you have to look here, and it's a dragon. It's got teeth. Right. It's got fire. The one thing that, and Kieran Matthews, he may not have been an A-list actor.
But he made a bunch of movies.
He made a nice life for himself.
Right. And the thing is, Catherine Grant here, again, she didn't act in many, many movies because she got married to Bing Crosby and then she was with the kid. And that's what she was. She was a wife. And she even said that. She said she
cut off her acting career
to be a mom. And that's a respectable thing. And she's a very, pretty woman. Yeah. And she's very, at this time, she's not Ursula Andress in the fur bikini that we would see later in Women in Beers B.C. Raquel Welch.
Yeah, Ursula Andress
not
is
Ursula
Doctor.
And Dr. No. That's what I was saying. Yeah. She's not Ursula Andress coming out of the water in Dr. No. She's not Raquel Welch in the fur bikini. She's not even Carolyn Monroe in Golden Voyage. Like, those were the Hammer women.
Yeah. Actually, if you talk about the Hammer women,
Ingrid Pitt and...
Ingrid Pitt. It was Victoria Vitri.
Yeah,
when dinosaurs ruled the world.
Earth, yeah.
I mean, in my opinion... from strictly a male point of view, she blows Raquel Welch away.
Well, but again, the thing is, she's not in that mold.
No, she's
very respectable. She's not wearing regular, I would assume, garb of the what would have been that a time. She looks to be in Arabian clothing, but she's not. Her breasts aren't hanging out. She's not scantily clad. It's very respectable. This is definitely not the I don't know how to say this. This is the most respectable version of what the princess has ever looked like in a Sinbad movie, right, or what Sinbad looks like. They're all the clean cut, whatever, which is 1958, which makes sense.
Sure.
And you know what? I think that's why this movie endures. So something brought up here. In September of 58, Dell 4 Color, number 944. That is the Dell comic book of this movie. Which is outstanding. The cover is him with the wheel, right?
It's
the painting.
Is it
a painting?
No. It's actually the storm scene.
It's the actual picture. I don't remember if it was a painting or not.
Yeah.
But it's and that's a very. I mean, in this house, my dad's not a huge comic book guy. He's not reading Thor and Hulk and whatever. But you want to talk about
having movie comic books?
He has a bunch. And Marvel did this in a two. Luke would know more about this, and Luke will talk about this when we do Golden eventually. The two issue, we have one of them. There are the two issues that Marvel did that told the entire story, and it was done to look like a comic book, like a real comic book and stuff, not just a movie accurate. But that has the Cyclops on the cover, Sinbad's got the sword out. It's just kind of stuff. But the one thing about this movie is that, obviously we both love it, and it's a movie that's beloved by not just us, but this was when Ray Harryhausen won his Honorary Academy Award. Ray Bradbury presented it to him, of course. Ray Bradbury with him had been longtime friends, thanks going way back to when they were kids, and because, as Ray Bradbury says, he was into dinosaurs, and I like dinosaurs, and it's like, well, yes, this is what it built that. But Tom Hanks was the one who introduced Ray Bradbury, getting up there. And Tom Hanks said, when I was growing up, it wasn't Citizen Kane, it was Seven Voyages of Sinbad. And this is a movie that, I mean, as I might love Jason and the Argonauts, and Jason and the Argonauts is a great movie, this is probably the better movie than Jason and the Argonauts. Jason and the Argonauts has Talos, who I just love, and the fight scenes and stuff. But this is the better movie. This is a movie that my daughter has watched for years and years and years. We threw it on this morning. She was excited to watch it again. This is a movie that, again, it may be, and there's some things in here. If your kids are maybe a little, there's a skeleton, but, it's not, a bloody skeleton. There's no blood. There's no nudity. There's no, bad language. No one dies. I mean, people die in that they are no longer there.
Right.
Kind of thing. This is the kind of fantasy movie that was made for a youth audience, but didn't insult the adults in the theater. And I think that's part of the problem. When you look at some of the stuff from the 50s and 60s and into the early 70s, it was either made to be highbrow, and it's not for kids, or it was made to be juvenile, and it was for kids, and it was insulting adults' intelligence. The nice part about this, it doesn't insult adults' intelligence. It tells a good story.
I mean, as I mentioned earlier, right in the opening, this was a seminal moment for me as a young boy. I mean, at this point, I had not seen many movies. I think the first movie I ever saw was The Greatest Show on Earth in the North Bronx at a theater called The Paradise, which was just a Taj Mahal of a movie theater. And then the next movie I saw was, I believe it was Samson and Delilah. And then it was about two or three years later, when I was old enough to go to the movies on my own, we went to a place called the Burke Theater. And for a quarter, there was four movies. There was a Western, mm-hmm. A monster movie, usually, a comedy, and then there was maybe a documentary, and then there was a ton of cartoons. And my mom my dad would give me the quarter. We'd go there, and you'd get there at 11 o'clock in the morning, and you didn't come home until 5, which was perfect for them. They could clean the house, that you weren't underfoot. But when I saw this movie, this thing, for the rest of my life now, and if you could see what I'm looking at right now, which is my sunroom that has maybe 500 models built all around, I would say 3-5% of them are Harryhausen and Harryhausen only.
No, more than 3-5% of them.
Of 500?
Of the models? I mean, it's probably closer to 20% of the models that... Think about it. You have an entire... I mean, we're looking
right.
At,
yes, that's
3-5% are this movie. Harryhausen is probably about 20-30% of the models in the room are Harryhausen. And then the other big part would be, obviously, King Kong.
Right.
You know, anything, if you took stop motion, that's 50% of the room minimum.
Right.
Right. And then you have Universal Monsters, and that's going to take them because there's, the mummies and the things like that. But that's all the stuff that makes this up. This is what we're talking about.
And that's what, that's been my hobby. I mean, I love sports and I love cars, but my passion is these models. And Harryhausen had more influence on me than a lot of other people in this world.
Yeah. So, all right, folks. Again, I think we've hit everything here. If you during this,
well, I just want to say,
oh, sure.
Again, this movie is readily available all over.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if you can get it on Blu-ray, get it on Blu-ray. It and if it's not that expensive, because as I said, the one thing about Blu-ray, the live action is pristine, and that if you're watching something like the old VHS tapes and it's grainy. It's just newsworthy, but the Blu-ray of this particular movie is well worth getting.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about. The Blu-ray of this movie, it's available by itself in the regular, it's just Seven Voyages of Sinbad, and that's on Amazon. Go to the Two True Freaks website, click on the Amazon link right at the top, which will then take you there, and then anything you buy in the next session obviously helps us out. What happens is the movie itself is available on Blu-ray, and that's like $13. You can probably get it used for like $7. It was part of the Ray Harryhausen collection and the Blu-ray disc in there. And that's got 20 Million Miles to Earth. It Came from Beneath the Sea, Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, and Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. If you don't own this and you don't own Jason and the Argonauts, and you'd actually like to get the one I bought, because I originally had these, and I picked up, it's the Australian release. It's available on Amazon and on, Dad, you got yours off eBay, right? It's an Australian release, so it's all regions. So it's A, B, and C. So anywhere in the world. So even the people over in England, if they want it or whatever, they can get their hands on it too. It's called what? The
Fantastic Films of Ray Harryhausen.
Right. And that's Jason and the Argonauts, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Golden Voyage of Sinbad, and Sinbad the Eye of the Tiger. I got mine for like $34 with Prime shipping. You got yours on Amazon, not Amazon, on eBay.
Yeah.
And it was like, what, like 30?
It was 32, and I was lucky enough I had $15 of my eBay bucks.
Right, I'm saying. So, we're not talking about break the bank.
Right.
But you're saying...
But you're getting four
Blu-rays. And there's no other way to get the Blu-rays of Golden Voyage of Sinbad and Eye of the Tiger... without buying an import anyway. There's no U.S. release of them. So you're already going to buy the import anyway. And those run $17 to $20 a piece.
Each, right.
Yeah. So, and you're thinking like, well, I don't know. Golden Voyage of Sinbad is a very good movie. Eye of the Tiger is a very good movie. They have crazy, like, the special effects in those movies, and we'll cover them. Those special effects there are, like, again, Harryhausen just kept getting better. It's not like his stuff got worse. It got better as it went on. And as Dad was saying, those in the 70s, the film stock is better, the quality is better, and he was able to get... Harryhausen's name was synonymous with, like, by this point, as being a top-notch effects guy.
The guy.
Right, the guy. And in the 70s, his movies... You would hear about it a year in advance. People are like, oh my God, I have to see. It's like now when they say Last Jedi, you know, and it's like the other day, what is it, like 250 days to Last Jedi, and people were losing their stuff over it.
That's when it's coming out.
Oh, it's coming out in December, right?
Oh, I thought, okay, good.
Right? But people were like, oh my God, Last Jedi, because the new poster's out with Rey with the lightsaber.
Ah, okay.
And everyone's losing their stuff over it. I'm like, well, they would do the same thing. You would go to the theater and it'd be like, the new Rey Harryhausen, and they would put a trailer out, and it would have very little in the trailer. It would have a little bit of his little, like, test shots, and people were like, this one's going to have a dinosaur, or this one's going to have a saber-toothed tiger, or this one's going to have this. I mean, Golden Voyage of Sinbad, they don't show you anything in the trailer, and then still you're like, well, it's going to be awesome, you know, kind of thing. And so you get excited about it, and you'd hype up, and when it would come, you go see it. It's well worth the $30 if you want to buy this on Blu-ray. It is, I have the disc. We watched it this morning. They're beautiful. The Australian discs are the same as the U.S. disc for
Jason and
Sinbad, and it's the same as it would be. They have the same menus as the DVDs of Golden and Eye of the Tiger,
which are important too because
they have the featurettes, the documentary featurettes on there are outstanding about the other movies. It's not even just about them. So, like I said, folks, clearly this is a movie. It's a very influential movie. This is, I know a lot of people really like our Them episode. That was way back at episode number 2, because Them was a very important movie. And then, you know, when you look at Harryhausen stuff, and I know some people have their favorites. They like the Emir better than they like the Beast or whatever. I've never met anybody who enjoys these type of movies who doesn't love this movie, right? To me, this is one of the 10 best movies ever made, period. I hold this in the same, you know, esteem that I hold movies like Gladiator and things like that. And it's easy to see the love on the screen. I mean, the actors did the best they could do with everything they got, and no one was mailing it in. Charles Schneer knew he had a moneymaker all the time when Harryhausen thing was attached to it, and Harryhausen loved this. And this is his Arabian Tales, is what he wanted to tell. So, again, if you have any feedback on this, let us know. You know, drop us an email here at the show. We'll read it on here. I'm sure there are definitely people out there who are maybe between my dad's age and my age who saw this when it was like rerun again in the 70s and stuff, when they were revivals of things, or maybe you caught it on TV as a kid, or maybe this is something, maybe you're, you know, that you as a kid grew up watching. This is one of your favorite movies, even though maybe you never saw other Harryhausen movies.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, this is one of the key movies that Turner Classic Movies shows. It's mm-hmm. and Jason Jorgens, on at least 4 or 5 times a year.
Well, Harryhausen's birthday is June. It's June 29th, yeah. Right? So what happens is he would show, when they show the Harryhausen movies, they say, well, we're paying a tribute to Ray Harryhausen. They don't go and try to get, like, they show Seven Voyages of Sinbad, Jason and the Argonauts, and then something else. Sometimes it's the Beast. Sometimes it's the 20 Million Miles to Earth. Sometimes it's Mysterious Island.
And
very rarely.
Clash of the Titans.
Clash of the Titans is the other one they love showing, because Clash of the Titans was, you know, again, even though he did very minimal work in that movie because he was getting to be the point his health was failing. But they show this movie and Jason and the Argonauts. Why? Because you had to have... It's like you have to have that defining best of things. This is probably him at his best. You can argue maybe you like the flying saucers and Earth vs. Flying Saucers are outstanding. You could say maybe I like this better, that monster better, but this is him doing the best he does. It's all on the screen. So, like I said, if you have any feedback for us, let us know. We love hearing from you. If you want to tell us, hey, I love this movie. Hey, I've never seen this movie. Hey, you know, you guys talking about it made me to go to the movie theater, or not the movie theater, go, you know, rent it and go see this. Because I've had people say that. Like, I've never heard of, and then fill in the blank of the movie. Or, I haven't seen this movie since I was 10 years old. I'm now 50. I just rediscovered it. I love this. Whatever it might be. And so, you know, thinking, what's coming up next? Well, you know, we've been, again, this is 1958. I know we like being in 58, 57. We're going to move ahead now into the 70s. And the movie is called S. And it's the movie where, you know, snakes and people get together.
Who's the I'm trying to remember.
It's Dirk Benedict, isn't it?
Yeah, Dirk Benedict, right.
He's,
and wasn't he one of the
he's
the
on the A-team. He's face from the A-team.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very different movie. I cannot say that it is similar, but it's a very different movie. It's one. Again, it's a 70s movie, so you're going to look at, and it's a 70 movies that takes place in the 70s, so you're talking like big collars and, you know, the hair and the cars and everything else. But, you know, we try to make sure we give you something different. We're not trying to give you, we could just do Ray Harryhausen's movies in a row and do all of them, and then be like, okay, now we're going to do these movies all in a row. And would that be cool? Yes, because we know them inside and out, but I think we're trying to give you different things. And I hope that some people, because some of the feedback we've heard when we did The Crawling Eye, and then we did, well, Santa's Sleigh, which was different. Yeah. And then we did The Abominable Snowman. People are like, oh my God, The Abominable Snowman. I haven't seen that movie in forever. Or Crawling Eye, I remember that. We're trying to bring back those things. Was a movie that was on TV. Channel 7 would show that thing at like 3 in the morning. I remember you had to tape it.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get on Channel 7. You had to go to Channel 8. 7 and 8 were both ABC affiliates, but 8 was clearer than 7. So we recorded it one time. It had commercials, the whole nine. But it was just, and it was dark as anything because it was the 70s when, you know, movies weren't cleaned up. That actually just got a release on Blu-ray, but we'll talk about that next time. We're trying to give you guys a little different stuff. If you have suggestions, write in. Let us know, because we've had some people write in with stuff, and it's hard sometimes when people write in, because I always respond back to everybody, and then we read their stuff on the show, and I'm like, I don't want to say too much, but yes, you know, things like that, and I'm like, or it's coming, or please be patient, you know, because Dad and I plan things out. We're looking at, well, where can we place things? What makes sense? We don't want to double up with the same thing back to back sometimes, you know, because it doesn't make sense that way. You know, kind of like hit the same topics over and over. So we're definitely going to try and do that. And we have some other special stuff coming for you down the road. You know, if anything you want to give us feedback on, we love hearing it. Anything else? I think we're good, right?
No, this has been a pleasure today.
Yeah. So keep those cards and letters coming, and keep watching the skies.
This is Tokyo, once a city of 6 million people. What has happened here was caused by a force which, up until a few days ago, was entirely beyond the scope of man's imagination. Tokyo, a smoldering memorial to the unknown. An unknown which at this very moment still prevails and could at any time lash out with its terrible destruction anywhere else in the world.
Hi, folks. Luke Giaconetti here. I'd like to ask you a few questions. Do you like giant monsters, or as they're called in Japan, Daikaiju? Monsters like Godzilla, Rodan, Gamera, King Ghidorah, or Mothra? Do you like more obscure monsters, such as Gappa or Yangari? Do you like giant heroes like Ultraman, or super robots like the Shogun Warriors? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then I think you might like my podcast, Earth Destruction Directive. I'm a dedicated fan of all things Daikaiju, and I'd like to share that with all of you. Please check out Earth Destruction Directive at twotruefreaks.com. Earth Destruction Directive, where we turn your Daikaiju dreams into city-smashing reality.
This has been an episode of Bots, Bugs, and Babes, the B-Movie Podcast. If you'd like to contact me, please email the show at botsbugsbabes@gmail.com. If you'd like to find me online, I'm on Facebook under my name, Jason Giaconetti. I often contribute to the Two True Freaks Facebook group. You can visit my Facebook page, The Art of Horror Collective, and you can search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective. On Instagram, find me under my name, Jason Giaconetti, and search the hashtag The Art of Horror Collective, as well as the new hashtag Bots, Bugs, Babes Podcast. I'm the only one using them. I'm also on Twitter at Jason Giaconetti, and you can visit my webpage at www.theartofhorrorcollective.wordpress.com. All movies, characters, stories, music, etc. are properties of their respective holders. This is a fan work, and any use of any property is purely for review, discussion, entertainment. So don't sue me. I ain't got anything anyway.
There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow! There is no tomorrow!
Will you stop?